Welcome to A Certain Age, a show for women who are unafraid to age out loud. Beauties, A Certain Age has listeners in over 118 countries across 8,000 cities. We may not share the same zip code, country, or language, but there is no doubt in my mind that we share the same desire to look and feel our best, to have our bodies and our sex lives keep humming for the long haul. But we don't get to midlife without running into body and health changes and challenges, both big and small. My guest today is a woman who helps other women manage the peaks and valleys of women's health and gynecology, and who knows firsthand what it takes to live through major health challenges while remaining committed to optimal health. Dr. Shiva Gofrani is an OBGYN of 24 years and is the founder of a tribe called V, a virtual platform offering resources and education for all things V, from pregnancy to postpartum, fertility, gynecology, menopause, hormonal health, and overall well-being. If you're navigating uncertainty around gynecological or hormonal health, if you're tackling a biggie like cancer, if you want to set aside fear, anxiety, or avoidance when it comes to managing midlife healthcare musts, colonoscopies and mammograms, looking at you, stick around. This show is for you. Plus, we're going to do a deep dive into vaginal estrogen. So excited to cover this all. Welcome, Shiva.
Hi, thank you for having me. I love talking about all things vagina, vulva, any V word.
We're here for it. I am V word, very, very excited to dive into this with you. I follow you on Instagram. You bring such a refreshing, open, you know, just honest conversation around this. I'm not surprised at all. You've been an OBGYN for 24 years. You're deeply trained, deeply experienced, but I know that your work is also rooted in your time spent as a patient. So I would love it, just as a sort of quick intro, as a starting off point, can you share a little bit of your own personal story with A Certain Age listeners?
Yes. And the truth is, I say this very openly and publicly frequently, that I wish for all of us as women and people with vaginas and vulvas that we could all be much more open with each other, if not publicly necessarily, but just with each other, with our small groups and little tribes, so that we feel better about the human condition. Because once we start sharing our stories, we realize how much all the stories overlap and we're not alone. And so in my case, besides being a physician, being a wife, being a doctor, being a mother, I also have been through so many different gynecological and obstetrical health issues, which sounds ironic as a doctor who deals with these every day for my patients, but it's really helped inform me. So, you know, a joke, it's like a little laundry list. I've had 6 miscarriages. I've had 3 babies, and my first one had an intrauterine stroke. My second one was born with a club foot. My third one was a surprise pregnancy, which sounds strange for someone who considers herself to be a good gynecologist, but a surprise pregnancy at age 40. I had endometriosis that was undiagnosed, like it is for many women, for much of my life until I was 29 and ended up with a 17-centimeter ovarian cyst. I've dealt with weight my entire life, up and down, had bariatric surgery for it, and I would say it still is a big battle. And it all culminated in me having ovarian cancer when I was 46. And now I'm 53 and kind of in the throes of being a postmenopausal person forever. And so all of these experiences were both, like everything in life, I joke, miserable and magical. They sucked. And yet each one presented opportunities for me to learn about myself and to really learn how to help women with the anxieties associated with all of their health issues that we never get to learn about. And yeah. So that really is something I feel strongly about. Yeah.
What an incredible, journey you've been through. Thank you so much for sharing it so candidly, like not only with my listeners, but on your Instagram. I really feel like I agree with you. You know, when we share our stories, we feel less alone. Creating this podcast has taught me that so many women are sort of suffering in silence. I've featured urologist on the show who tell me that women come to them 10 years too late after suffering from, you know, sort of life-changing bladder issues. I talk to women who are, you know, like you, who are gynecologists, who help women who deal with painful sex and sort of other taboo topics all the time. And when we sort of strip away the taboo, we can get women the resources that they need. So, you know, Thank you for being a guest and for sharing your story and for the work that you do with your patients. And I love that you're bringing it to a bigger audience. And I know that you talk frequently too about how managing physical health often requires managing our mindset. So you listed all the challenges that you went through. You know, do you feel that going through those challenges helped you counsel patients on mindset? Walk us through a little bit about how you managed your own challenges.
Yeah, I think I was very lucky, obviously, right? When you go through anything, but you have a little bit more information preemptively. I mean, one of the words I love is preemptive knowledge. When you have preemptive knowledge about something, it helps you, right? Because you have that a little bit of the preemptive, the anxiety that is associated with it, but you also have the knowledge to know that you will likely get through this issue. I think that's an important topic to continue to delve into, because I say to people all the time, we do not, as humans, concretely, intentionally remind ourselves that we have each been through a lot of hard, challenging things. Like, without even knowing you well, I know you yourself have been through a million things, I'm sure. And if we all took the time to remind ourselves and say, I went through miscarriages, I went through cancer, I went through my, you know, father being diagnosed with Alzheimer's, whatever it is that I've been through, and yet I'm still here, it would help us so much the minute the next big thing comes around. And so early in my kind of career, when I was just a fresh attending, I had already had two miscarriages. And this was 22 years ago now. And so that really started the ball rolling for me to realize, yes, this sucks. Yes, this is anxiety provoking. And I have to allow myself to sit in it and not sugarcoat it and not have any toxic positivity about it. But I can also recognize that I will be on the other side of it. And so when I then had my first baby after the two miscarriages, I was able to say, oh, okay, here are the reasons that I can find within what happened. I don't think things happen for a reason, but I always say I can find reason within it. And the reason within it was that concretely miscarriages happen. They're very common. They're very sad. But then I was able to have this beautiful, healthy, you know, challenging pregnancy with the child who then ultimately also had had an intrauterine stroke. And yet again, he was still alive and a person that is now 19 years old. So all those little journeys reminded me each time to intentionally put that thought into my mind that I will go through things, as a joke. I'll swear and we can bleep it out, but shit is going to happen. Right?
You can swear as much as you like. This is a show about grown-up women. We can do these things.
And I actually say this to my children. I'm not going to sugarcoat it, kids. Shit is going to happen in your life. The sooner you accept that fact without being negative about it, right? I think it doesn't have to be a, oh my God, bad things are going to happen. It has to be a, listen, life realistically is fraught with issues because we have concrete bodies that are just going to crap out sometimes. Let's accept that these things will happen. Let's find the beauty within the suck. Let's be able to cry and be upset about it when we need to be. And let's, each time it happens, intentionally place that thought in your mind that you have now overcome something and you will be able to do it again. Because all too often, what I find with my patients is they'll say things like, I'm so scared that I'm going to have an abnormal mammogram or an abnormal pap smear, or I live in fear that I'm going to have a miscarriage, right? Like, these are the three common things I hear from women. And when I kind of, I don't even want to say gently, aggressively remind them that those things are common, that those things still suck and are sad, but that they will probably have one, if not all three of those things at some point in their lifetime, and they will still be okay. And that they have shown themselves that they've been okay in the past when they've overcome other things. Many of them kind of stop and go, oh, I didn't even think about it. You're right. I already had XYZ happen and it was terrible. And here I am and I'm okay. So why am I engaging in fear over the next thing that might happen? Yeah. And so I think a lot of it is that we just have to be very explicit. I think we all, I realize as adults, especially, I think many people will say to me, well, you live by example, right? And I always say, no. I think it's necessary, but not sufficient to lead by example. I think we actually do best when we hear concrete ideologies and verbiage as to what we need to teach our brain. And so what I want to teach my children and other women is to reflect on what you've been through. Tell yourself that you've been through these things and that you've come out on the other side to help prepare you for the next thing. Because every single one of us on this panel and anyone who's listening will go through something big again, if not 10 more big things.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you, Shiva, because nobody gets to the north side of 40, but you probably don't get to the north side of 30 without having gone through something hard. You know, every single person who's listening to this conversation today went through like a life-changing global pandemic. and we made it through, you know, and we go through things like the loss of loved ones and healthcare challenges. And I love that you share with your patients that reminder that you can and have done hard things and you will again. But I also think that, you know, there's when you were talking about how you have patients who worry about certain things, too, I think that I'm going to say this at least for myself. I have wasted a lot of time pre-worrying about things that have never come to pass. And I honestly feel that getting to midlife has somewhat cured me of that, because I realize I have a little less time to waste and I'm no longer spending it on stuff that may never happen. And, you know, we worry about a lot of things that never come to pass. What's your take on that?
Well, I love that it's cured you of it, but I think you should take some credit, because I will tell you, having taken care of and continuing to take care of women in midlife, many women still, again, and some of these women are people who have been through big things. They've already proven to themselves that they can survive big things, right? And yet they still somehow want to attach to that notion of preemptive fear instead of preemptive knowledge of, I might have an abnormal mammogram. Why will I bother worrying about it yet when I haven't even had it yet, is the first prong, right? And then the second layer to that, I keep trying to remind people, if we keep using mammograms as an example, you can be anxious about your mammogram, but to be fearful is silly, first of all, because the odds of it being abnormal are not so small. It might come back abnormal. The odds of an abnormal mammogram then becoming fine are very high. And the second prong to, again, don't bother worrying about it until it happens, is even in the worst case scenario where you go in for a mammogram, it turns out to be abnormal, and you have a biopsy and it turns out to be cancer, the vast, vast, vast majority of the time, that cancer will have been found early. You'll get either surgical or chemo treatment for it, and you will be okay. And so I think that's where I really want people to be more realistic and mature. I think people want to be anxious about the little thing, like anxious that just the abnormal mammogram, when in fact, that abnormal mammogram is common. Instead, what we should really intentionally be anxious about is missing the opportunities to find and fix the things that we can find and fix.
That's what we're going to cover next, Shiva, this intentional anxiety, which I love. We're heading into a break, but when we come back, I want to talk about sort of intentional anxiety and planning versus pre-worrying. We'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read, a podcast about the books that built our souls. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. Don't miss it. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hannah to Jhumpa Lahiri, Susie Essman, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they talk, they share. You can join us on Instagram for more behind-the-scenes content and giveaways at You Are What You Read Podcast and at Adriana Trigiani. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Erica, one third of the podcast, Books and Betches, a comedy book podcast where we swear, spoil, and we talk about...
Whoa, 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 whoa. You cannot say that in this.
What do you mean? That's like our slogan. It's our gimmick.
It is, but just say we're a very funny adult book podcast.
How about we just give some examples of things we talk about?
Well, there's a lot of chaos.
I'm Kristen, and with me I have...
Wobbler!
No.
We talk about books, but we're not your AP Lit class.
I definitely hit on the major points.
You absolutely did not.
She did.
You talked
just
about...
not in the order you thought she would.
You talked so slowly about one thing.
A lot of sidebar conversations.
Are you denying the existence of chupacabras?
You know what, Erica? Yes, I am.
And we don't always get the facts right.
Epilogues don't belong in books.
Dude, call it chapter one.
That's a
the
prologue.
The second I see...
That's a prologue.
Oh,
I'm talking about prologues.
You can listen to new episodes of the Books and Betches podcast every Tuesday morning, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Bye-bye.
Shiva, we're back from the break. When we went into it, we talked about how pre-worrying is a total waste of time, but that planning, you know, which sometimes is informed by what I think you were calling intentional anxiety, is a good idea, right? Because when we like work a healthcare plan, when we are proactive, we can sometimes prevent these worries. So I want to hear from you, you know,
you're counseling patients all the time that are worried about mammograms, that might be worried about, like, you know, doing things they don't want to do. Like, nobody wants to do colonoscopies. How do you counsel a listener who might be avoiding these midlife must-dos?
So many different ways and layers to discuss this. Two things I'll say, like, as broad categories. So first is that I really like, one of my many isms is, let's be proactive, not paranoid, right? In other words, paranoia would be, I'm so scared of my mammogram, I'm so scared of my colonoscopy, I'm so fearful of whatever. Whereas proactive is, ugh, I don't really want to do my mammogram, but I'm going to do it because I would rather find something early. So that's one aspect, is being proactive, not paranoid. Because when we're paranoid, what happens is most patients end up being so paranoid that at some point they practice avoidance. And that's the real concern I have with the paranoia or the fear. Fear of the mammogram or colonoscopy or pap smear or fear of a miscarriage or fear of whatever is going to lead to unnecessary angst, right? There's some necessary angst and there's unnecessary, but also it's going to lead to avoidance. So that's one part of it. The second part is that I think people really need to be, like I said before this segment started, more mature about how we approach it. If someone comes to me and says, I'm just so scared I'm going to have an abnormal mammogram and find out I have cancer. I mean, I hear about cancer every day. It's just so scary. My response is often, well, actually, because you hear about it so frequently, that should be an indication that maybe you shouldn't be scared, that instead, let's be mature. Let's accept that the reality is that it is not so uncommon for people nowadays to find out they have breast cancer, but that, again, the vast majority, if they do their screening mammograms once every, I would still advocate for once every year, then they will likely find it early and it will be fixed, which doesn't mean that the journey to finding it and fixing it is easy or not fraught with, like, crap, right? But it means that there's no reason to fear it. We should really put the fear basket in the things that are truly, truly detrimental to our ultimate ability to stay on this earth, right? And those are relatively small things. Most of us are going to get through these things and be okay on the other side. And so again, that common theme of realistically accept that something is going to happen without it being doomsday, so that it doesn't lead you to avoiding the tests and ideas that will help you get through that and be able to fix things. That's something that I think is so important. And again, it's not explicitly discussed enough. And so that's where I say, like, leading by example isn't enough. Because if you say to 10 women, you know, one or two of you are going to end up with breast cancer in the next whatever, they'll all be like, that's so scary. When in reality, we should say, no. In fact, this offers us the opportunity to be proactive. Let's figure it out. Let's find it soon. Let's fix it so you can be on the other side.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to me, that can be calming. Yeah.
And I also think it gives you so much mental peace. And I will say that I just recently booked my mammogram. I'm having it in a week or two. And my doctor wrote me the script in December. And so this show is coming out in July. And it literally took me 6 months to, you know, move it off the desk, you know, pile, and pick up the phone and make the call. And when I called.
Because of being busy or because of anxiety?
You know, no, I wouldn't say it was anxiety, but it's more like, it just felt like an onerous to do. And I kind of forgot, like, time had sped by so much. And when I called, I had it was like the call of shame. I'm like, can I still use my old prescription from 6 months ago? And the woman laughed and she said, I hope so, because mine's about that out of date too. This is the receptionist. So I'm saying to everyone who's listening, don't be me and the receptionist. You know, pick up the phone and call for the screenings that you need, because it takes a while sometimes to get these appointments. I just saw my cardiologist and it took me 10 weeks to get that appointment because he was busy. And I feel so much better for having done it. And it wasn't anxiety or fear, but it was more like just not prioritizing something that felt like one of those adulting to-dos that you never want to do. So
I will tell you a little tip that is not easy in every practice, because not everyone will do this. But I used to have my patients, when they walked out of their annual exam with me, I had my staff open up my schedule a year out every single. So they would walk out and they would schedule their annual a year right then and there. Because I knew what would happen if I said, okay, you're going to be back in a year, a couple months go by, they'd forget, then they'd end up calling like 3 months ahead of time, I would get booked out for months, they wouldn't, you know, and it would be a mess. Now, some practices won't open up the schedule a year ahead of time, they'll only open up about 6 months ahead of time. So if you're with a practice like that, for your gynecologist, for your internist, or for your mammogram, then my other tip is mark in your calendar that day when you've had your mammogram for 6 months later. And 6 months later, you call ahead to get your next mammogram 6 months after that, right?
I love that tip. By the way, I'm going to, Shiva, this is embarrassing, but I do that when I get my hair colored. I am not leaving that salon without booking the next appointment. Because I'm like, I am not going to have these roots for one day longer than I need to. Yet here I am, like, twiddling my thumbs about doing these other things. So I think, I bet a lot of listeners can relate to that. So I love your advice of just, like, prioritize it like your hair color appointment, ladies, because it will absolutely get done. So what are some of the, what are the, some of the screens that you really, I know this is sort of broad and we're, but what's, what are must do screens that you want to see women doing in midlife that they may or may not be? I just did a DEXA bone scan a couple of months ago. Is that one of them? Right. What do you recommend to your patients?
Okay. And let me preface by saying, because I'm an OBGYN, that is my lens a little bit. In other words, you should still be making sure that you are seeing your primary care doctor. I would personally tell you that I would love for patients to see their primary care doctor once a year, whether or not they have the need for it, because at least their annual exam each year will ideally be a boring screening test where they just get everything done and chit chat with their doctor. And you want it that way. I've had patients say, well, every year I just go and everything's the same. The answer is yes, it's supposed to be the same and good. And the bigger purpose to me of going once a year and consistently doing it is so you have a relationship with your primary care so that if, or more likely when, as we discussed before, something happens, you already know them well enough that you can call, pick up the phone, go in and see them. If you don't have a relationship with them or you haven't seen them in 3 or 4 years, the honest answer is it's sometimes hard to get into a primary care right away. So I think it's very valuable to see your regular primary care once a year and your gynecologist once a year, even though, to touch upon screening tests, many people equate seeing their gynecologist with just a pap smear, and they might know that the pap smear guidelines now are that you really only need your pap smear every 3 to 5 years, sometimes once a year, but depending on your risk factors, previous pap smears, pap smears are something that you will get at anywhere from 1 to 5 year intervals. And many people unfortunately conflate the fact that they don't need a pap smear more than once, let's say every 3 years, to not going to the gynecologist as well. And that's not really the case. You should see your gynecologist every year because besides your pap smear, they do other exams, your breast exam, they look at your vulva, they do an exam of your pelvis, and they talk to you about screening tools. And again, just like with your primary care, they then have a relationship with you so that if your mammogram comes back abnormal, you can call your gynecologist and get in to see them to have the discussion.
Yes.
So those are two kind of general screenings. And then with regard to tests, I would say keep up with your pap smear and make sure you keep track of it. Having the doctors be the only ones keeping track of it sounds great, but we all know doctors are very busy. It doesn't always transmit with regard to like how often you need it and how, when you've had your last one. So I would keep that kind of stuff in your phone, like keep it on your calendar when you've had it done. But a pap smear is anywhere from 1 to 5 years, again, depending on various risk factors. You have to ask them each time when you should do it and when you should repeat it. I still advocate for a mammogram starting at least at 40 and doing it every year. And I say that because there are varying guidelines, some of which would start you later and have you do it every 2 years. But most of the guidelines nowadays say at least start at 40, not later. Some people start at 35 or even earlier based on other risk factors. Colonoscopy, now we should absolutely start at 45, not 50 like we used to say. And that's regardless of any risk factors or family history. That is a screening colonoscopy at 45. And then bone density is where the guidelines are a little bit fuzzy. Like you had said, a DEXA scan, which is a bone density. I think it really depends on a lot of different risk factors. So it's not as easy a slam dunk. And the reason I think many of us are a little more cautious about kind of advocating for that all the time is that the treatment for osteoporosis and osteopenia, which is where your bone density is changed and leads you to have more of a risk of fracturing, especially your hip or your spine, the treatments for it are not kind of as straightforward as treatment, for example, for breast cancer. And so that's why I think many of us, if we're going to be a little bit fuzzy about guidelines, that's where I and many gynecologists probably feel a little bit fuzzier. But it is a good idea to discuss your bone density or what's called DEXA scan with your primary care and gynecologist and start it anywhere in your late 40s to mid 60s, just depending on various risk factors, like when you went through menopause, whether or not, for example, you're on thyroid medication, if you've had a long history of steroid use, if you're very lean and fair skinned because your frame, your bones might be a little bit less dense. So there's a lot of different ways to approach that.
Yeah, such great advice. I did not have fear around colonoscopies. It's honestly, it's like the prep's no fun, but it's the world's best nap. You know, mammograms, I don't dread those either, even though I was lazy about getting it done. But I was a little bit nervous about the DEXA scan because I am like small framed and fair. And I, you know, had a past life as a smoker when I was in high school and college. So I was really worried I had done some, you know, irreparable damage to my bones. And I felt amazing to hear that, you know, the fact that I quit smoking and that I, like, you know, do a lot of exercise and do a lot of, you know, bone friendly sports, like, you know, high impact sports, like racket sports. Mm-hmm. That I got a clean bill of health and it did feel amazing. So, I recommend people to, you know, get those scans done that Shiva just outlined. Yeah. I want to switch gears for a minute, though, and ask you a little bit about, I mean, you share that you had ovarian cancer. You're a gynecologist. I'm curious if we could just sort of touch quickly on HRT and whether or not, you know, for any of the listeners who are not choosing HRT now actively without consultation with their doctor because of concerns about cancer, do you recommend them having a conversation with their doctors? Can you do anything to alleviate people's fear around the HRT cancer link?
Yes. I mean, Lord, we could do an entire, we could do 10 episodes on this and still not even get to the root of everything. But in a nutshell, many people probably have heard that the guidance and knowledge about hormones has changed dramatically, even just in the last, couple years. And our ability to talk about it very, very frequently and openly has also changed in the last year, I'd say even. And just to give you a teeny bit of background, I know you know this, but for your listeners, the WHI, the Women's Health Initiative study, which was back in the early 2000s, came out really saying that hormones were bad. And women got ripped off their hormones literally overnight. And it said that basically it increases the risk of breast cancer, therefore everyone should be off of it. And that was coming off of decades of us saying, it's good for you, it's good for your bones, it's good for your health, it's good to decrease all things like cardiovascular risk with maybe a small increased risk of breast cancer. And again, that study basically made it seem as if breast cancer is the biggest risk, take you off hormones immediately. And so now we've had essentially two decades of women being scared of hormones. Luckily, the pendulum has swung to where all the data has really isn't completed yet, but a lot of great data that shows that that study was flawed for many different reasons. We were using formulations that we don't use as regularly anymore. We're really using much more what are called bioidentical formulations, which not bioidentical necessarily in the compounded form from independent pharmacies, but bioidentical formulations that are mimicking the hormones that we have in our body that are very safe, that are used from commercial pharmacies and FDA approved formulations. And so because of that new guidance and understanding that many of us kind of knew from the beginning, but now it's being more publicly discussed in social media and in all of the news conferences and everything, I think women are starting to learn about it. So I urge any person who is not only gone through menopause, but is perimenopausal, meaning in that stretch, anywhere from their mid to late 30s into their 50s, where they're still getting their period, but their hormones are starting to change, I urge them to talk to their doctors about it, because the doctors might not always bring it up for a lot of different reasons, not the least of which is they don't always have the time. But talk about it, because we know much more. And we know that using estrogen and progesterone, depending on whether or not you need both, can really impact not only how you feel going through perimenopause and being postmenopausal, but absolutely can impactfully help your body, and especially your brain. We're finding out so much more about dementia. We know it can protect your bones. We know it can decrease the risk of colon cancer. So there is a lot of value in considering hormones. And that doesn't mean that every single woman needs to be on it or should be on it. And there are certainly some risk factors. But the obvious risk factors that people thought, like, oh my God, I can't go on it because it increases the risk of breast cancer, is really not, I don't want to say it's completely untrue, but it was very much overblown. And we really need to do a lot of work to go back in time and try to fix that fear that women have.
Yeah,
because it's too bad if they don't get the help they need with hormones, because it can be so impactful.
No, absolutely. And I, I learned this from creating this podcast. You know, honestly, having so many experts like yourself on the show who've educated me about the, HRT and all it can do to help, you know, with your vaginal health, with your bones, with your cardiac health, with dementia. It's just something that I started to explore myself with my doctor, and I, you know, brought it up and I said, tell me about what you think are the risks. Here's my, you know, risk factors. What do you think? And we came up with a plan together, and I'm thrilled. You know, I'm so happy that I sort of took control of this. And I think that, but I didn't have the concern about cancer, and I know you've gone through that. So I just want to make sure it's clear for our listeners. So if somebody has had cancer, has a concern about breast cancer, Do you recommend that they bring that up with their cancer doctor? Or do you recommend they bring it up with their gynecologist? You know, is it both? What do you recommend to help women alleviate this fear?
Here's the honest answer, and then we should touch upon vaginal estrogen quickly. But sadly, my answer is you should bring it up with both your oncologist and your gynecologist. And your primary care only if they happen to have a big interest in it. But to be honest, the primary care doctors have so many other things to address that they're probably not going to be as knowledgeable about hormones. And so you should bring it up with both. And the answer should be if they both summarily say, absolutely not, you had breast cancer, therefore you cannot be on hormone replacement. And even if they say, because you were estrogen receptor positive, meaning your tumor had estrogen receptors on it, you cannot be on it. Then I personally would say maybe also talk to someone who has really learned the much more up-to-date information, because many doctors are still unfortunately quoting the WHI study because they have not had time on their own to research the newest data. And that's not doctor's fault. Again, there's so much we have to look into all the time that some just aren't as steeped in what's updated in this part because they've learned other things. And so if you really want to know more, or you think you need hormones or want to be on them, then you should talk to both oncologist, gynecologist, and if they both say no, then I'd never want to say doctor shop to seek out a third opinion, because you can always find an opinion that's going to agree with you, but find someone who is really well-versed. And there are some doctors out there who really know this stuff very well, and they've been very intimately involved in all of the data and studies.
Yeah, great advice. You need to educate yourself and then advocate for yourself and, you know, potentially find a doctor. I know the National NAMS, the National Association of Menopause Specialists, has doctors who have continued to get training in menopause and could be a great starting place. So that's terrific advice, Shiva. So let's switch gears now and talk about vaginal estrogen. I believe you say this is a midlife must, right, for any person who's got a vulva, and that you share three things with patients to help them, you know, when they consider whether or not they want to add vaginal estrogen to their weekly care routines. So what are those three factors?
Well, and let me just say,
there are probably more than three, but
Well, there's a couple, but in the discussion of how challenging it is to discuss perimenopausal and postmenopausal hormones, when we're discussing systemic hormones, which would be patches, pills, ring, things like that, that is such a complicated topic. In contrast, I would actually say vaginal estrogen is not as complicated, thank God. So I think if every single person with a vulva and vagina hears about it, they will gain a lot. So if that's all we could ever touch upon, it would be great. But basically, as you go through perimenopause and then become postmenopausal and your estrogen levels change and decrease, your vagina, which is the inside part, and then the vulva, which is the outside part, will be less elastic. A lot of people use the word dry. I don't like the word dry because then it implies that just lubricating is enough, and that's not enough. Many women use lubrication. It still hurts when they have sex or when they ride a bike or when they even just have underwear hitting it. And that's because the tissue is less elastic from the lack of estrogen. So that's just the background to understand what's happening. And when I prescribe vaginal estrogen, I typically try to start with the cream because I think it provides the most coverage. And so it really can get on the vulva and in the vagina, as opposed to using the vaginal tablet, the vaginal ring, or vaginal suppositories, all of which are good. But I think the cream works best. Patients need to know a couple of things. One is that this is not systemic hormones. So even if you have had breast cancer, this is very safe. This is not getting into your system. So the risk of blood clot, stroke, heart attack, breast cancer is not there. And unfortunately, many practicing physicians who I love and value and trust, but they are still scaring women by saying, oh, you had cancer, you can't use vaginal estrogen. And that's really just too bad, because it can help in so many ways, not only improving sex and sexual relations, but also decreasing urinary tract infections. So one is you need to know that it's safe. Two is you need to know that, unfortunately, despite being safe, the package insert is literally going to say this can cause breast cancer. And it's wrong. It is really, that is the package insert that was for the systemic hormone replacement. And even that needs to change. But the FDA put it in the package insert for vaginal estrogen. So in my younger years, I would prescribe it and then patients would call and be like, I can't take it. You said it doesn't cause cancer, but the package insert says it does. So I now preemptively tell patients, package insert will say breast cancer, ignore it. I also tell them that insurance may or may not cover it, because your insurance company does not care about your inelastic vagina and vulva, even though they should, right? Because they'll be saving on urinary tract infection medications and things like that. You also need to know that if they don't cover it, you can get it now from pharmacies. Like, not to advocate for any one pharmacy, but there are now commercial pharmacies that are offering things to patients at much lower prices. So if you can't go to like your regular CVS, Walgreens, places like that, because your insurance won't cover it, there are mail order pharmacies that will make it much cheaper. And then the last thing is you have to know that you have to use it regularly for it to work. So when patients say, well, how long do I need to use this for? My answer is, as long as you want to use your vulva and your vagina, you should be.
You're like, this is an end of time situation. You're going to be using this till the end of your days. Yes. How often do you use it during a week? Is this once or twice?
Yeah, well, it depends. And again, I'm always going to say, listen to your doctor or nurse right. practitioner or PA who prescribed it. But for the most part, the formula, like the vaginal cream, which let me reiterate, is actually a bioidentical cream, meaning it is mimicking the hormone that we have in our own body. So it's estradiol cream that typically is used twice a week. So some people will start it every night for 2 weeks and then switch to twice a week. The easier way for most of us is to just prescribe it twice a week, twice a week, twice a week, twice a week, meaning Monday and Thursday or Tuesday and Friday. So kind of 3 or 4 days apart. And it comes with an applicator. The applicator is quite annoying. I actually often will tell my patients, use the applicator at the beginning so you know the dose that you are going to be using. It's typically, most of us start with 1.5 gram twice a week, but after a while, you'll notice that that amount is kind of like the strip of a toothpaste, and it's easier to just not use the applicator, put it on your finger and rub it on the outside and push it up on the inside. It's such a simple thing to do that I really wish we could get that word out to every single person who's perimenopausal, postmenopausal, even women who are breastfeeding will have benefits from using vaginal estrogen, because any state where you are low on estrogen.
Well, I'm happy to help get the word out because and also thank you for educating me that I should stop saying dry vagina, because I say that a lot on the show. Yeah. And I sometimes joke that if I can help cure a dry vagina, my work is done. But
Listen, doctors say it too for ease. Inelastic
but now I'm going to say, if I can help cure inelastic vaginas, inelastic my work is vagina. Done. But people should not be suffering. And I know that urinary tract infections are, very consequential as you age, and that women wind up in hospitals when they're older because of this. And you do need to take care of yourself. One of the things, I'm going to be honest here, and I do use the estradiol cream, but I find it to be messy. So I'm not as consistent as I should be. And I'm curious about the suppositories and supplements. I know, you prefer the cream, but talk to us a little bit about what does a supplement, a suppository look like? What does the tablet look like? How do they work?
Yep. Okay. So there's the tablet that the brand name was Vagifem. There's a generic called Yuvafem. It's a tiny little tablet. Ironically, it comes with like 30 applicators or however many because you're using that twice a week as well. On one hand, it's so much easier to place. It's a little tablet. You use the applicator or you just use your finger, put it all the way in, and it liquefies, and it definitely causes, I would say, less of a thicker discharge, but a little bit more of a watery discharge. And the downside is it's getting into your vagina. It's not helping your vulva as much. I mean, theoretically, it is targeting your vagina and part of your vulva, but it just won't get all over. And so that's the downside, right? Because when you think about it, when we were younger and we had our hormones in that normal up and down cycle, we had more discharge. And discharge is, we could have a whole conversation about discharge and how triggering discharge is for women, and that we hate our discharge, but the discharge is a normal physiological process that keeps everything lubricated. And it's a reflection that our tissue is lubricated and elastic. So again, the tablet is twice a week, which makes it easier. I just personally have found with myself and my patients that it didn't seem to help, especially with the vulva, as much. The other form is there's a vaginal ring that is nice in that you put it in and it stays in for 3 months. Most of the time you can put it in and out yourself. Sometimes you have to go to the doctor because it's a little bit more rigid than a birth control ring, for example. And so you might have trouble putting it in and out. But again, the nice part is it just sits there. You don't have to worry. And even though it mostly affects your vagina more than your vulva, I would say anecdotally, I think it helps a little bit better than the tablet still. But again, in contrast, doesn't help as well as the cream. And then there is an entirely different class of DHEAS suppositories, very easy to put in. That's formulated to use actually every single night, though most patients find that they don't need it every single night. They could probably get away with, 4 to 5 times a week. And DHEAS, which is a different hormone, will then in the cells convert into estrogen and testosterone. So that's nice in that it's not a cream. You don't have to slather it all over. I do find that because people are using it regularly, they don't forget. And then it does seem to help the vagina and the vulva, but still you'll get a discharge. I mean, it's kind of like one of those good news, bad news. Like, it would be great if we could find a way to elasticize the vulva and the vagina without discharge. But if you think about the skin on your face, There's no way to use various products that help keep it elastic that don't make it feel a little bit almost oily, right? It's hard to feel dry and elastic at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so funny. Well, you've convinced me with the dry skin thing too, because I use a wonderful face oil that I learned from having a woman named Carrie Gran on the show. I adore her face oil, and it does make me feel not dry. And I'm happy about that. So I need to just sort of reframe my mindset and just, be less upset about the estradiol. But I do use it, but I do find myself sometimes thinking, it's depending upon where I'm going, what I'm wearing, when I want to put it in. And I'm not quite as good about using it, but you've further motivated me, which is why I have these shows. This is why I have these conversations, because when I talk to women like you, I get excited about doing the things that I know I need to do to take care of myself. And I hope our listeners are excited as well, particularly because you've outlined at least four different options that women can use to make vaginal estrogen a part of your life, right?
And that's why I would urge them to try the different formulations if they don't like, for you as well. If you don't like the discharge, try the other ones, because you might have a different experience than what I've anecdotally seen, right? And so I never want to act like there's only one right way to do any of these things. There are multiple ways to it. Most importantly, what I think you and I both want is for women to recognize that they can talk about it with their doctor, that they should talk about it with their doctor, that they shouldn't be embarrassed, that it's very common for this to happen. It's actually borders on what I would call normal, right? It's normal for us to lose the elasticity over time. And if we just made this one important, impactful difference, it would be so great for our health.
Yeah, absolutely. So when for a listener, because my listeners range in age, it's kind of 40 to 65 or so. Do you recommend people start using this in perimenopause, right when you start to experience some of the symptoms of slowing periods? Is this something that you do when you're fully in menopause? What's the timing?
It depends. And so just to reiterate for your listeners, who I hope know, but they might not, because many of my most educated friends don't even realize that perimenopause, again, can start mid to late 30s, if not early 40s, because it can last 10 plus years. And it's just that time where your hormones are starting to shift and change. Maybe evidenced by irregular periods, but maybe it's just subtle things like I feel a little more hot at night, I feel a little bit more moody, I feel a little bit more weight around my middle. Subtle things can be a sign of perimenopause. And so when patients come in and have those subtle signs and I say to them, oh, you might be perimenopausal, and I joke that I always call it the other P word because they're like, what? What are you talking about? I won't tell them that they should start the cream yet. It really depends on them. Meaning if they say, no, I'm actually not having any trouble when I have sex, if I even still feel like having sex, it doesn't hurt, it doesn't feel, I don't have any trouble, or I use a lubricant and that's good enough because I'm not in pain, then they don't need to start it. In other words, it's not as though you should start it preemptively because you've lost the battle if you haven't started it. You can start once you start to notice discomfort, either with intercourse, with, again, if you spin a lot and you notice that when everything's rubbing against the bike seat, it hurts, or you're having recurrent urinary tract infections. Those are the times where I would say start it. And certainly, even if you don't have any of those things, recognize that once you become postmenopausal, your hot flashes, night sweats, things like that might abate over time and go down, but your vaginal inelasticity will only potentially get more and more and more.
Right. And so that's such an important distinction to say that this is not just when you're suffering from some of the symptoms. This is an ongoing maintenance that you need to do to keep these tissues healthy for the long run, because even at some point, if you're not having an intimate or sex life, maybe you're single, but you still want your tissues to protect you from things like urinary tract infections taking hold. And I love your bike example, right? You need to take care of this body part for your healthy living and a vibrant aging. It's not simply about making your sex life less painful.
Right. And many people don't have sex with a partner, but even on their own, if they're using a vibrator or something like that, they might need to make sure that that tissue still feels really elastic. Because many women will say, I used a lubricant, but it still burned and hurt. And that is because that tissue is what we need when we actually are having intercourse or if we're doing anything with ourselves. We need that transition where the tissue becomes more lubricated and more elastic, and the vagina and vulva actually kind of lengthen and thicken and do a lot of different things. So merely putting a lubricant on it, which is what we've been told for decades, right, as women, just lubricate, that's not enough. So yeah, I think that I think we've made it clear.
I think we've made it clear. Vaginal estrogen all the way. Yes. Figure out what works for you. I love it. Thank you so much. We're going to head into our speed round in a few minutes because we're nearing the end of our time. But before we do, I have a question. I know I said at the top of the show, you've got a fabulous Instagram. You share like really helpful, frank advice on a range of topics. I definitely recommend everyone check it out. It's called @BigLoveFierceJuju. But my question is, why Big Love Fierce Juju? What does that mean to you?
So I'm going to try to make this quick. But when I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, about 2 weeks later, one of my friends, who's also a patient, who's actually a nurse at our hospital, was just diagnosed with breast cancer. And we'd been calling and texting back and forth. And I said, one of my texts I ended with, okay, I'm sending you my big love. And it just didn't feel like enough. But I also just didn't feel right saying prayers because while I'm very, very spiritual, I'm not religious. So I said, I'm sending you my big love. And then I said, and fierce juju. And it seemed to just be like the right mix of, I want to be concrete. I want to love you. I want to, you know, educate you. And I love that little bit of whimsical, like juju. And juju to me is not evil eye where I think people are casting a spell on us or looking ill on us. It is that kind of indescribable little feeling of goodness and sometimes a little bit of luck and just, you know, that folly. And so that just became a tag that I thought was fun. Now we're kind of in this transition because my business partner, I have our company called Tribe Called V, which is an OBGYN platform to really help educate women on all the things that they've never learned as far as any of their health concerns. And we're in this inflection point where we're actually going to change our name and our branding. And I kind of need to know if I'm going to switch to being like Dr. Shiva G or Big Love Fierce Juju. And I'm really conflicted because I love the juju part.
I love it also. I don't know. Maybe we'll get our listeners to vote. So when I share this and when I put it on Instagram, I will ask you guys to weigh in. You can vote for what you think Shiva should use. But Big Love Fierce Juju, I love it. I love that idea of just, you know, warmth, support, good vibes, energy, and a little bit of like, I don't know, maybe like steel in our spine, a little bit of, you know, fierceness. All right, Shiva, we are going to head into our speed round. This has been so educational. You've gotten me super excited about being more consistent with my vaginal estrogen. I appreciate that. But our speed round is just the way we close. It's just 1 to 2 word answers so we can end on a high note and cover a little bit more ground before we say goodbye. Are you ready?
Perfect. Yes.
Okay. I could talk about this midlife health topic over and over again.
Yes. Wait, what am I'm supposed to give you a word?
Which one? Which
midlife health topic? Oh, I could talk about perimenopause.
Nice. Okay. A menopause or perimenopause resource, either a book, a podcast, a thought leader that needs to be on our radar.
NAMS, the North American Menopause Society.
Nice. Very good. So you share a lot of fabulous content on your Instagram. What's a topic that always resonates with your audience?
I'm going to give you 5 topics quick. HPV, go. Herpes, perimenopause, menopause, pregnancy loss.
Okay. Those are biggies. This lifestyle choice fuels your peace of mind.
Finally lifting weights.
Ooh, I'm doing that too.
Oh, gosh, it's been a long time coming.
Yeah, it took me a couple years, but I do it once a week now. I should probably do it more, but, you know, we can't do everything. This menopause-friendly food is always in my grocery cart.
You're going to laugh, but organic heavy cream.
Ooh.
Do you want me to expand onto why?
Yeah, why?
I'm actually a fan of time-restricted eating or intermittent fasting, depending on how you look at it. And so when I have my coffee in the morning, I put a little scooch of the organic heavy cream in it. It doesn't break my fast. It makes it yummy. And it doesn't have any sugar in it because sugar is a big trigger for hot flashes, as is caffeine and alcohol, by the way. But caffeine I can get away with. And so if I have caffeine with a little scooch of organic heavy cream, it helps me with the long-term weight issues I've always had.
I had Dr. Mary Claire Haver on the show who wrote the book, The Galveston Diet. And the book is a great resource for anyone who's curious about time-restricted eating and making some different kinds of health choices. And she shared that one of the hardest things for her was saying goodbye to the sort of the sugary coffee that she loved in the morning. So this is a great workaround. You know, you can have coffee with this little scoop of cream. So that's very nice. Cool. Okay, finally, what's your one word answer to complete the sentence? As I age, I feel
more at ease.
More at ease. I love
three
it.
Words.
I love it. Three words. Me too. This is Shiva, this has been such a treat. I love following your Instagram. You share great, great advice. You get people, you know, it's informative, it's fun, it's straight talking. I encourage all of our listeners to go check it out. Before we say goodbye, though, how can our listeners find you, your work, and A Tribe Called V, and your podcast, which I know is coming?
Yes. So I'm mostly on Instagram, and they can either look up Shiva Gofrani or Big Love Fierce Juju. And our website is tribecalledv.com. So just tribecalledv.com, soon to be renamed, but for now, tribecalledv.com. I would love for people to come sign up for our email list. We send out newsletters that are not spammy and not even that frequent, but they will also be able to learn about the different things that we have to offer. We have a lot of free content, and then we have different classes. We have a pregnancy class. I just gave a perimenopause Zoom a couple of weeks ago, and there's going to be more and more to add to that, because I really know that this can be a great resource for people across their entire spectrum, from their very first period all the way past their last period, like into their eighth and ninth decade of life, because there's so many aspects of women's health that we do not learn about in OBGYN health and people with uterus, ovaries, vaginas, and vulvas health. So we need to learn about all of it.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. I'm putting all of those in the show notes. Thank you so much, Shiva. This wraps A Certain Age, a show for women who are aging without apology. Want more of A Certain Age? Sign up for our newsletter, Age Boldly, over on our website, acertainagepod.com. Or follow us on Instagram at A Certain Age Pod. We share bonus content, giveaways, links, and midlife resources. Come hang out with us on Instagram. Special thanks to Michael Mancini, who composed and produced our theme music. See you next time, and until then, age boldly, beauties.